Welcome to Leading Lions, a podcast from Vanderbilt University. I'm your host, Derek Brough, Director of the Vanderbilt Center for Teaching. In this podcast, we explore creative, intentional, and effective uses of technology to enhance student learning, uses that point the way to the future of educational technology in college and university settings. Through interviews with educators, researchers, technologists, and others, we hope to amplify ideas and voices that are, or should be, shaping how we think about digital learning and digital pedagogy. In this episode, I interview George Siemens, Executive Director of the Learning Innovation and Networked Knowledge Research Lab at the University of Texas at Arlington. George is an internationally known expert in digital networked and open learning. Among his other accomplishments, he co-taught the very first massive open online courses, commonly known as MOOCs, back in 2008. His Connectivist MOOCs featured peer-to-peer learning through blogs, Twitter, and other platforms. These days, George continues to lead research efforts into MOOCs and other forms of digital learning. George was on campus at Vanderbilt in the spring to give a talk as part of the Schmidt Family Educational Technologies lecture series, and he was kind enough to sit down with me for a little while to talk about the present and future of educational technology. George has a way of thinking and talking about technology that helps me step back and appreciate the big picture, and we're honored to have him as our first guest on Leading Lines. I'm going to start with a big question, but it's one that I know that you've thought about. Let's get out our crystal balls a little bit. Given the work that you're doing now, what do you see for the future of colleges and universities, particularly as technology shapes that future?
I think in a lot of ways, they'll continue to exist. I know there's been a lot of narrative that has come in a number of circles about universities are dying or the future. You know, we're going to see half as many universities. I think theorists like Christensen and others have made some really strong statements about that. I just think there's absolutely no evidence that supports those opinions. So currently, if you look at major developing regions of the world, they're putting much more dollars into the existing university system rather than actually pulling back. One example recently with Saudi Arabia, they've announced something in the range of a $2 trillion innovation fund or future economic fund, recognizing that eventually their oil source will dry up. And a big part of that is obviously focused on university. Their King Abdullah University of Science and Technology was created to the tune of $30 billion to try and bridge a knowledge economy. Same thing with China, massive, massive investments in the future of their university system. So, to start, I just want to emphasize that that's not changing. Universities are going to be here in the future. There likely will be a few systems here and there that will close or that will, smaller systems that might not be successful or whatever else comes of that at an individual level. But by and large, the idea of universities as the knowledge backbone of a society, as an innovation backbone of a society, I don't expect that that's going to change in the next 15 to 20 years. I do think it'll be augmented. It'll be augmented by a range of other knowledge providers, such as, let's say, code academies or these boot camps to help people get skilled to work in a particular sector. That may come up as something that'll grow in influence, but that's really reflective of the demographic shifts that, let's just say hypothetically, in 50 years ago, we needed, let's say, 15,000 hours of learning to enter a solid degree. Nowadays, it's doubled and tripled because we have to learn constantly. If you're somebody who's a programmer working for Facebook, you're constantly having to learn and update your skills and learn new approaches, new methods, new models of the work that you're doing. It's the same holds true in all areas of society. We just need to learn more and learn more constantly than we ever have. So from that end, there's an expansion of the learning pie, so to speak, even though there's a number of providers that are adding on that we didn't have before. So that's just really a simple view in my case is that in the future, we're going to see more, not less, involvement of university systems in our lives. That may take a different form. There may be more of a blended approach. There may be more of a partly online or fully online even, but still linked back to the university identity. And one way I've described it in the past is that whereas we may have a generation ago had a 4-year relationship with a university, in the future we're going to have something along the lines of a 40-year relationship where we keep returning to the university to reskill and upgrade back to the labor market, back to the university, back to the labor market.
Will there come a day where we don't have courses or classrooms?
That's a really interesting question. I don't know. I think there will be a day where we don't have exclusively courses and we don't have exclusively classrooms. I think it's possible that, for example, as I'm involved in working, the course of my job, education, that I have something that looks like a personal learning graph that details what I know and how I've come to know it, and has some way of me communicating my capability back to an employer or to a prospective employer. And then I may need to go to university to gap fill some of those areas, and that may not be delivered through an existing pre-structured program or course. It may end up being something that looks much more like a computed curriculum, meaning that it's addressed real time for me. So this, the idea of personalized and adaptive learning, is that I attend a campus and I'm provided the curriculum that addresses the knowledge gaps that I have in order for me to get that degree. So I might not have to take a two-year certificate in 2 years. I may be able to complete that in 3 months if it accounts for what I've already learned based on this knowledge graph that I've built while I was working, while I was volunteering, and so on. So it's possible we don't have that. But even now, if you look at it, how long haven't we been able to meet online for events and conferences and so on? And yet the conference circuit, if anything, has exploded. You know, there's more conferences every year. And so you'd say, well, yeah, but I could just as soon watch that online, or I could just as soon do whatever. And we do a lot of that. So it's not that we don't watch YouTube or TED Talk or instructional videos online. Instead, what it is that we're doing that, but still meeting as we traditionally are. So I think the future, and one of the interesting aspects of technology, is it's almost always additive. We like to think it replaces. We talk like it replaces. But look to a university IT department. If you have an LMS and somebody comes along and says we should do ePortfolio, you don't do an LMS or ePortfolios, you do an LMS and ePortfolios. Then someone says, oh, we should do something like a domain of one's own, or everybody should have their own blog. Well, now you're going to have an LMS, an ePortfolio, and blogs added on. Then someone will come by and say, we want to use an adaptive learning system. And then, so that's the component of technology. It's highly additive. I think in the same regard, we will still have courses, but we'll also have a range of additional approaches and ways of helping students learn that's more relevant of their life context and their personal learning needs at that time.
Given some of those possibilities, right, out on the horizon, what would you like to see happen in educational technology in, say, the next 3 years?
My big research interest right now is on social and affect. And so with Link Research Lab, the focus that I have and that we as a group of researchers have is, what does it mean to be human in a digital age? So that's sort of our driving question is, what happens to the human in this experience? And I think this is relevant because we're hearing these murmurings of how society is going to change due to automated technologies. One example I recently read looked at the 3.5 million truck drivers in the U.S. could be obsolete within 5 to 10 years because of self-driving trucks. You don't need people driving it. That's an enormous impact on the economy to have a truck driving job, which is reasonably well-paying. My dad was actually a truck driver, and a reasonably well-paying type of work. And to have that all be gone and automated, that has interesting implications in terms of what our learning needs are going to be and what society looks like. So from that end, my short-term and actually I'd say long-term question is, what becomes of the human in the midst of these upheavals? If we see and continue to hear about Google being able to beat the world Go champion, or IBM when Watson won Jeopardy, and these other kinds of innovations that we see from AI, then I'm starting to wonder what does that mean to us. And so from an educational technology, and there's a few trends that are significant now. I don't know if they're going to be sustainable or what I'll call alpha trends. So alpha trends are the ones that reorient a whole field or an entire way of thinking, whereas a lot of secondary trends, they're there. They make an impact, and they change what we do as practices, but they don't necessarily completely alter everything. For a while there, everybody was talking about MOOCs like they were this big new thing that was going to change the university. People like Clay Shirky wrote that this is, MOOCs are the MP3 moment in higher education, and Udacity, which was at that time, they're now a corporate learning provider, but at that time they were one of the early MOOC providers, and that Udacity was going to be our Napster. So there's a lot of people making hugely bold proclamations, and now we look at it and it's like, well, MOOCs are terrific, they're relevant, they're useful, but they're not an alpha trend. They're not changing the conversation the way that people predicted they would. Competency-based education, I don't know if that's going to be something that's going to change everything. It'll be something that'll have an impact. Now we're hearing about blockchain as an assessment or as a credentialing type of a model.
What is blockchain?
It's a really good question. So blockchain basically, and there's a recent post that Audrey Waters did on addressing this, but it's basically, for lack of a better, a ledger. It's a way of keeping track of something that's happened. It was developed in a tight conjunction, or at least it flowed out of Bitcoin. So we're not flowing out. It was central to Bitcoin. But the idea of this, everything that happens to this transaction is encoded and it can't be changed. So it's a permanent, non-changeable entity, which means that you have greater trust in it because you can see everything that's happened to this. And so that idea of a blockchain, namely the series of links and connections, so it's a ledger of everything that's happened to a something. It could be a currency, it could be a bank transaction, it could be a learning pathway and so on, or the learning that I've done. And the whole system, the integrity is within the system, so you can't just change one part of the system without the rest of the system being influenced by this. So that's, I think, essentially one way that people who've looked at badging are starting to think, well, maybe this way of the blockchain idea as a credentialing approach could have some potential interest and so on. But again, all these things coming up, whether we're talking mobiles, we're talking wearables, we're talking competency-based learning, we're talking personalized and adaptive learning, there's just this enormous range of new ways of looking at teaching and learning and education. I think anyone who picks the winner at this point is lucky, because we really don't know which trends will stick, which ones are going to be consequential, which ones are just going to be sort of short-term passing trends. I mean, even a few years ago, it was digital badges were going to change everything. They might still, but you don't hear much about digital badges anymore as a learning accrediting approach the way that we were hearing even 2 years ago.
I have to say, I'm typically skeptical of the "it's going to change everything" argument, right? I mean, I remember the days of Second Life and how somehow this virtual reality was going to change how we do universities. And when you look back at it, well, it was kind of useful here and there, but it was enormously resource intensive and it just kind of didn't scale in the way that would actually affect any kind of change. And so, I mean, I do think about kind of characteristics of technologies or trends that are likely to have a bigger impact or a lesser impact. A lot of my work is in teaching with clickers, which I have seen used in all disciplines, right? Yeah. In kind of all kind of classroom settings. And so that's something it has going for it, in that it seems kind of adaptable enough that you can see some widespread use. Now, is everyone going to be teaching with clickers? No, like that hasn't happened, right? We've hit about maybe 10% faculty adoption, and it's maybe we'll hit 15 one day, but it's not transforming how we do kind of classroom learning, right? Yeah. But it's useful, right? And it's interesting. And I think a lot of these trends will have uses and will be interesting in different ways.
Oh, I absolutely agree. Dimension of technology as an additive agent, I think, is something that's worth considering, which just means we have more options. I mean, we really are in the age of choice. So it's not just that we have 10 channels on TV that we're dealing with, it's we have 500. And to add to that 500, we have Netflix, and then we have iTunes or a range of other sources of watching videos, and Hulu. And so it's really the age of choice. And that diversification of options is becoming more evident in education, not just from a choices for how we teach, though there's many of those there, because we can use an LMS, we can use a classroom, we can go blended, we can use clickers, we can use adaptive software, we can use blogs, so there's a huge range of options. But also from a student end. So from a student end, it's, faculty member, she lectured about the Stanford Prison Experiment. Well, you go, rather than reading it in a text, you can go onto YouTube and actually see an interview with the research leads and some of the participants in the Stanford Prison Experiment. And we have this huge range of teaching and learning options that we didn't have in the past. A recent report at MIT addressed this as well, that one of the top uses of the MOOCs that they were running was actually for their on-campus students to revisit lectures that they had maybe not fully understood in class, or there were some practice activities that were sometimes involved with some of their computer science courses. They can engage in those activities. So it's just this broadening of options and growing range of interests, and just matching our educational options, teaching and learning, to the general explosion of options we have in other areas of our lives.
Let me ask about one of those kind of option sets, because I know it's one that you've looked at, and that's learning analytics. Mm. I hear a lot about learning analytics and their potential to enhance teaching and learning. I sometimes think maybe I hear too much. I mean, there's a lot of noise. What's the signal there, right? Yeah. What are learning analytics as you think of them? And what kind of potential do you see in their future in higher education?
But learning analytics largely is the use of data that we have available to us about students and their learning process and activities in order to improve the effectiveness and the quality of their learning experiences. So or trying a simpler way, it's just using data to improve the success of learners. Now, there's, as with anything else, once you have a few corporate partners that are interested in it, and there's this, it's, you're not going to read an article or pick up newspaper if it says, here's a moderated view of how learning analytics may help. I mean, that's not going to sell. On the other hand, if you say all faculty will be obsolete in 20 years, says researchers, somebody will pick up that article because it's provocative, it's clickbait, but in the newspaper form. That's the same problem we have with learning analytics. Learning analytics aren't going to change the education system 100%, but they're going to impact every part of the education system. It'll impact how we recruit students. It'll impact how we teach in a classroom setting. It'll impact how students get feedback. It'll impact how we assign resources within an existing university setting and so on. So a few quick examples of what that might look like. Through the use of learning analytics, probably one of the first things that's gained a lot of attention is predictive models for student dropouts. So if there's indication that a student might drop out, do we have the ability to recognize that and then provide support services before they actually drop out? That's a, sort of an easy approach. More complex approaches are that of adaptive learning, where we would say to each student, this is the, you know, this is your level of knowledge in this course, so we can adapt the content either in terms of pace, flow, type of content, type of social interactions based on how the student is succeeding. So if you show that you're mastering concepts quickly, you get moved to a more advanced level quickly. If you show some difficulty, let's say, in a course that indicates, oh, you know, George hasn't mastered basic math concepts that we would expect a student at this level to have, it would sort of regress me, if you will, back to basic math instruction so that it could build my foundation for future learning. There's been other activities with it around recommender systems. Recommender systems can be social. You know, George, you should learn with Derek because he's a bright guy and he can help you learn better. He's mastered this concept and could serve as a good sort of student or peer mentor. There's also been content recommendation systems that have been used in this where this is the course you should take next, and if you take this other course next, there's a better chance or higher chance of you failing, so this is what we recommend. So learning analytics has, I think, the capability to make an impact on all parts of the system by making all agents functioning within a system more aware of what's actually happening. Beyond that, though, I think it's worth emphasizing that their future is not necessarily one of completely altering everything, but it is one that I think will influence how teachers make teaching decisions. It'll influence how students develop their self-regulation skills, because a big part of this idea of the quantified self, and this is reflected with wearable devices we already see, you know, your Fitbits and calorie intake or you know, apps and so on, that if we have better information about ourselves, there's the prospect then, not the guarantee, but there's the prospect that we're going to do a better job of self-regulating. And from a learning end, making me, for example, as a learner, aware of how I'm doing and what I'm doing may give me the tools to change my practices or my strategies when I'm involved in learning. So it's just bringing education up to speed with what's happening in other sectors of society around the use of data.
Are there concerns about learning analytics that we should keep in mind, things that might make us move more cautiously in certain directions?
Well, I think the biggest concern I have is around making the education process soulless. You know, you can't engineer learning the way that you can engineer a building. And learning is a social, complex process, and I'm concerned that our algorithmic approaches to it will end up sucking the soul out of it, and it'll become this lifeless, passionless experience where we're just clicking the next button to get the next knowledge nugget. That's my biggest concern. I have secondary concerns around privacy and ethics. Who has access to the data, especially with more corporations now involved in the university sector? Who's going to get access to that data, and what are they going to do with it? So I do definitely have some of those considerations and concerns as well. But by and large, it's about if we are committed to analytics, we need to take the idea of analytics and apply it to our analytics, meaning that we need to assess whether they're working the way that we said they would, whether we are getting the results that we expected we would get, and if we're not, then to revisit the ideas that we have. Maybe we find that this data-intensive model doesn't produce the better outcomes that we were promised, and then it's time to rethink. Maybe there's a different solution that we need to explore.
I'm curious about one of your current projects, the collaboration with Carnegie Mellon University. Can you tell us about the big data project and what you hope to learn from it?
Sure. So one of the projects we're involved with now, so together with Carolyn Rose out of Carnegie Mellon and a couple of her peers from CMU as well, is we're really just looking at how do the structures, the technological structures that we have, influence our ability to learn or to generate knowledge. And we're looking at three specific types of spaces. One is Wikipedia, which the way to collaborate and interact and create knowledge in there is fairly distinct. It was innovative 10 years ago, and it still is. It's become a little more hardened in terms of who's editor and who has access. So, but it's, how does knowledge get generated there? A second element is that of Stack Overflow, where we're seeing individuals who contribute in a Q&A type of site in terms of getting their challenging questions answered around programming or technology or other needs that they might have. And then the third relates to MOOCs, which is something I've been fairly involved with over the last few years. And as a result of that interest, we're trying to see if you're in a MOOC or if you're on Stack Overflow or if you're contributing to Wikipedia, how are we generating that knowledge? What is the editor model of Wikipedia? How does that influence knowledge generation versus, let's say, the freer flowing, anybody can answer a question that you might or ask and answer a question on a Stack Overflow type of setting, or with MOOCs, where you have a more traditional, there's still a faculty expert, but not the exclusive expert, meaning that in a MOOC, anyone can come in and be an expert, but we still heavily defer to that role. Like, we're really trying to get a better understanding of when these environments with these multiple kinds of interaction opportunities, how can we learn from different knowledge needs that we have as a society and bring that to bear within our classroom? Maybe there are certain kinds of knowledge activities that are better suited for open-ended collaborative discussions, and there's others that are better suited, because I'm certainly still a fan of a lecture, so when's a lecture appropriate? When's open group work appropriate? When is self-work appropriate?
Or, I don't know, what would the Wikipedia model, what might that look like in a university setting for as knowledge production or learning?
I think probably the easiest approach would be the generation of content. And given how expensive textbooks are right now, just a simple example, I don't see any reason why a group of graduate students together with, let's say, a psychology prof couldn't generate the introductory textbook as a Wikipedia project. And so the knowledge there is that Wikipedia overwrites individual identity, meaning it's really a collaborative project. So a Wikipedia page doesn't have a voice per se. There's a protocols and the editorship and so on around it. The talk page on a Wikipedia entry is where, you know, a lot of the mess is. But the page itself, it's not tied to an identity. So this is an opportunity for learners to have a reasonably authentic learning experience, writing a textbook as a graduate student or contributing to writing it, and then making that available to students who are at a first year level of education. I think that's just a simple example of what Wikipedia could help. When you're engaged in that, there's a few simple rules of Wikipedia, such as there's certain resource quality criteria that need to be met. So it's not that you can't just say any random stuff. So if you're full of nonsense, then there needs to be some standards for what is acceptable and what's not acceptable. There's also the idea of shared governance that occurs within a Wikipedia entry. These are practices that students engage in. If somebody calls into question the validity of an assumption or related difficulties that arise with those assumptions, such as, and Wikipedia periodically does lock down talk pages during periods of high controversy in order to let the heat of the emotions pass. So those are the kinds of skills I think from a university and collegial knowledge creation, understanding shared governance and shared processes and management, but still at the end of the day, recognizing that we have nothing if we're not willing to sort of concede and collaborate to produce a better outcome. If all we want to do is, you know, stick with our own perspectives and our viewpoints, we don't end up creating anything new. And so those are, I think, terrific experiences for students to go through.
I think one of the reasons I ask about Wikipedia is this authorship piece, right? Where I think in academia we place a high value on authorship and voice, and when that gets disguised, right, through the collaborative writing, I don't know. I found instructors, faculty often kind of push back against that.
Well, and that's why, as we were sort of talking a little bit earlier, is it's really about more choice rather than having to make a decision between one and the other. It's about having more options available so that in context A, we could do this. In context B, we could do that. So, for example, as a faculty member, if I want to take a group of my psychology or computer science students, graduate level students, through a course that has some interesting practical application, maybe get them to write the introductory web page for a first-year student. Say the student's a few hundred dollars and have an interesting learning experience. Then if I want to work on building my digital identity, let's say I'm a new faculty member, I'm pursuing tenure, and I have to address not only the traditional publication and grant criteria, I also have to meet teaching criteria that are increasingly common in a university setting as part of tenure, and I have to start to find a way to have my work make an impact. Well, in that case, I might say I'd like the identity value of a blog, a Twitter ID, maybe Instagram. I'd like the identity impact of personal authorship, but that is that context. So the context always drives the approach. As I've been, I think from my view at least, you know, the entire education experience, the entire learning process is really just a massive if-then statement. And we forget that sometimes, that it's always contextual. There are settings where a wiki is a great idea and other settings where it's a terrible idea. There's times where an academic needs her own voice and there's times where she doesn't. And it's really, there's really no answer that's right all the time, but there's almost always an answer that's more correct in one setting than it'll be in another setting. And getting that mindset, which my interests have been heavily around complexity theory and complexity sciences lately, because it, and by lately I mean the last 12 years, but because it addresses the fact that there are, we can't govern and practice education effectively through traditional rule-based approaches. It's much more about taking an ecosystem rather than an engineered model.
We have a standard question we ask all our guests on the podcast. What's your favorite analog educational technology?
Well, I love legal pad and paper and a pen. I mean, that's where I do the bulk of my sketching, and I still do. It's a way to connect and interact with ideas in very easy ways. There's something about the tactile experience. Research recently that emphasizes the value of note-taking with a pen and paper versus note-taking through a keyboard as better retention experiences for the individual students. So I still say good old pen and paper gets her done.
Awesome. Well, thank you, George. I appreciate your time and you taking this time to share a little bit of your experience and expertise with us.
Thanks, sir.
That was George Siemens, Executive Director of the Learning Innovation and Network Knowledge Research Lab at the University of Texas at Arlington. You've been listening to Leading Lines, a podcast on educational technology from Vanderbilt University. The podcast is produced by the Office of the Associate Provost for Digital Learning, the Center for Teaching, the Vanderbilt Institute for Digital Learning, and the Gene and Alexander Hurd Library. For more on the podcast, please visit our website, leadinglinespod.com, or follow us on Twitter at leadinglinespod. We would love to hear what you thought about this episode, so feel free to leave a comment on the website or on Twitter. We're planning to release two new episodes of Leading Lines each month this fall, each featuring an interview with someone with an interesting take on educational technology. We hope you'll subscribe. I'm your host, Derek Brough. Thanks for listening.